You're listening to the Concierge Coaches Show with Bruce Cameron and Wayne Fritz, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. Good afternoon, and welcome to another exciting episode of the Concierge Coaches Show here on LA Talk Radio. I'm Bruce Cameron. Wayne's out this week, but he'll be with us next time. But today, a long-awaited special guest, Dr. Aaron Pierce, and I'm real excited about having Dr. Pierce on the show. He and I have been friends and colleagues for many years, and he and I met back when I was active in the Federal Bureau of Prisons, as you guys know, and so I was really blessed to have have Aaron in a collegial capacity, and he also worked with a lot of federal sex offenders, still does, but did back then. But today, I really wanted to showcase what he's doing in his practice. I think sometimes, either as coaches or psychologists or counselors, you know, we can kind of get pigeonholed or get stuck doing, you know, the same thing over and over again. And I know, you know, by my own example, being a licensed professional counselor and then going to life coaching, executive coaching, and having this show on LA Talk Radio, kind of something off to the side. So Dr. Pierce did a very similar thing, and he's doing a fantastic job with how he's kind of diversifying his credentials and experience. So thank you for coming on the show today.
Oh, it's great to be here. Always great to see you too.
Yeah. If you could tell us a little bit about your trajectory, your path and credentials and licenses.
Sure.
And
stuff. Yeah. Yeah. You know, interestingly, I started off with just a master's degree, and the plan was to be a marital therapist. I had my own private practice doing that. And I started that in the very beginning, enjoyed it, but you know, it turns out I'm not a great marital therapist. So, you know, whenever you look at your clients and you say, gosh, you guys need to divorce, and you say that over and over with every client that you have come in, you realize that's not where I need to be. So, you know, I'd done a little work with a supervisor who did sex offender treatment. Okay. And he turned that over to me, and over time fell in love with that. And as you know, when you do that kind of work, you wind up in court. So started getting more involved with the court system and lacking that, thought a bit about going to law school, decided not to do that, and just move forward into forensic psychology. And so stayed that in that direction for my entire career. And today it's 28 years in doing this work and just growing along the way and adding new things to the practice and new services. And yeah, it's kind of been a great ride so far.
Well, good. Sounds like it. So talk a little bit, I guess, a few minutes about your sex offender treatment history, background, also your board affiliation,
sure.
Those things.
Sure. So again, I've been doing sex offender treatment for close to three decades. I had a trial a couple of years ago where I had to come up with a number that I've treated in my career. And at that time, it was about 4,000. So I've been working with sex offenders for a long time. And that includes individual sessions, group therapy sessions, a lot of work with probation and parole departments, state and federal. And for many years, that was about all I did. And I had each week, I had 10 groups that I would run, which was pretty intense, not just with the material, but dealing with that many people every week. But you certainly learn a lot about that population, about their backgrounds and their histories, and not just the deviant side of that world of sex offending, but also the personal side. With these individuals, you know, turns out they're people too. And, you know, they have families, they have lives. And so part of that whole process with them, treating them to reduce risk and recidivism, getting that to go down, you're also doing some, well, as you know, more of a global approach to kind of help them deal with other aspects of their life and help them to improve in different areas. So during that time, I was approached by our licensing board, one of the members there, about maybe applying to get on the board. And you know, thought that seemed kind of far-fetched to go deal with the governor's office and get into politics a bit. But did that and was appointed by then Governor Perry to my first six-year term. And it takes about 6 years to learn how all that stuff works, how to work with the legislature and talk to the politicians, giving them advice and so forth. But a lot of interesting things you do there with writing rules and standards of practice, putting things together from the scientific literature to help ensure that licensed therapists in our state are providing services that are empirically supported, and we know that they work and they do well. Interesting thing about Texas, of course, is we're one of the only states, as you know, that has a license for sex offender treatment. In most other states, you have to have a general license to do psychotherapy, and you can do that. But our legislature decided that we need to do more, and we want to have a license that has specific oversight from people who do this kind of work, because it's a unique population. And certainly the consequences if they don't get good treatment are pretty significant. Mm-hmm. So got appointed to second term with Governor Perry, and then Governor Abbott appointed me for a third term to be chair of the board. And so that's where I've been as of February 1st this year, 18 years.
That's fantastic. Yeah, it seemed like yesterday to me that you were in that capacity. And so, mm-hmm. Folks, this is real exciting. In one instance, I believe, on my license here, that is Dr. Pierce's signature right there, folks. So, and that's an old one. I have the new one up there. I had to make sure I was appropriately with my wallet renewal.
Yeah, I was making sure I'm not. Like,
okay, yeah, okay, yeah. Man.
Any violations here?
I need to have the flyer in the front if you have any complaints. who to call? But that's just fantastic. You know, I think when people hear about sex offender treatment background, mm-hmm. those things, you know, a lot of stereotypes and archetypes kind of fire off. But also I think, you know, with that, we talk, and I do want to talk a little bit about the business aspect of it, because a lot of our audience are clinicians and coaches.
Sure.
And I often say, hey, sometimes people can be good coaches, but not so good business people. You know what I mean? So, and I know you have been through the ringer with your business and having federal contracts. So if you would talk about some of the challenges and or successes of, because you've grown your business and now you're kind of, you know, resembling me as a boutique kind of guy as time wears on. But talk a little bit about your business growth and stuff.
Yeah, so, you know, in the early years, the work that I did was through referrals from the people I was working with, you know, being the youngest guy in the office, you know, all the clients that they didn't want to see came to me. And of course, I was very happy to do that, to get into the field and learn. But, you know, over time, you develop relationships with those referring agencies, probation and parole departments. One of the most important things I think that I ever did to help build the practice was actually getting out and going to those agencies and meeting people. Talking mm-hmm. to the officers, the individual officers who had their caseloads, talking to the supervisors or the chiefs of the department, you know, taking in my CV, talking to them about my treatment program, how I operate the program, and then also talking to them a little bit about some of the new research and the approaches that we need to be taking as a treatment team. You know, the treatment mm-hmm. team, the, mm-hmm. the therapist, the probation officer, and the polygraph examiner. And so, a lot of agencies were unfamiliar with that and still are to this day. And so I think, you know, educating them on that was a good way to build a relationship, and referrals increased quite a lot after doing that. I think that's always been a great way to build different aspects of the practice, you know, going out and meeting people, mm-hmm. developing those relationships. Those relationships are what become most important, even more so than reputation or how long you've been doing this. But yeah, you know, state work, and then of course kind of parlayed into doing some federal work, having an office in Waco, Texas, you know, kind of a smaller town, not as large as some of the cities I'm sure some of your viewers are living in. You know, there weren't many people doing this kind of work. I think even in Waco at the time, there were maybe three people licensed to do sex offender right. treatment. And so, In that context, it's a little easier to fall into those contracts. Of course, if you've ever done federal contracts, you know there's a lot of work.
Right. And one thing I want to make sure that you guys know is that he made those relationships, and then from those relationships, you then were invited to possibly put your name in and be considered mm-hmm. for a state contract or a federal contract. Mm-hmm. To see offenders. I just wanted to make sure.
Yeah, exactly. And that's true. You know, when you have those relationships and those contracts come up, the RFPs, you know, request for proposals, RFQs, you know, for quotes, that sort of thing. If they know you and you have that relationship, then yeah, you're going to be someone that they're going to submit an email to and let
keep going.
All right.
Yes, sir.
But, you know, would you be interested in putting in for these contracts? So you know,
go ahead.
There we go. So that would be, you know, something that I would recommend for everyone in terms of, you know, looking at how you build a practice. There really is, in forensic work anyway, there really is no such thing as just sitting in your office waiting for people to call. You know, it's different from your traditional mental health practice where you can have your ad in the paper or in the phone book or online. You really have to get out and develop those relationships to be able to get in position to have opportunities like that.
Yeah, and so you've done a real good job with that. And now let's talk a little bit about where your career is headed. I know you have a lot of different service lines, expert witness, risk evaluations, probably give us a little sampling of the different kind of area domains that you're doing now.
Sure. So one of the things I've always done that kind of grew into these other things I'll get to was doing risk assessments for sex offenders, violent offenders, drug offenders. And with that, you know, mitigation work, risk prognosis, so that whenever that offender was preparing to go to court, we go in for punishment and talk about those results and hopefully be able to say that this person poses a low risk to reoffend, their prognosis is good, and here are the recommendations for what we can do to help them be successful in the community. And as you know, prison sentences don't really reduce recidivism. You know, what we can also see, research is pretty clear, that if you take a low-risk offender and put them with high-risk offenders, like in a prison setting, you can turn a low-risk offender into a high-risk offender. And so if the interest is in community safety and building upon that, then keeping someone in the community when we can successfully is the most important thing.
Absolutely.
And so doing evaluations to help a court or a jury to understand that is something that I've always done. I've kind of moved more nowadays into the guilt-innocence side of work. One of the areas I do a lot of work is in false allegations of sex abuse.
Right, and I want to park there too a little bit, but keep going. And
sure.
I want to interject.
Yeah. So with that, what I do is I'll have a case presented to me, and I'll take a look at all the case facts, interview the client, talk with the lawyers. And what I look to see is if there's anything from the scientific literature on false allegations that crosses over onto those case facts. Is there a match? And while we can't go in and say, hey, this is unlikely to be true, this is a false allegation, what we can say is, in this case, we have these things present. For example, we have severe conflict in the family.
Right.
We have a divorce or custody battle going on.
Circumstantial types of stuff.
Right. Or we have, here are the motives that appear to be present. And so when you see those things present, the research says they can be in cases where there's a false allegation. And we tell the jury, hey, consider this as you're deliberating.
Right.
This is something that could be present, and then they take that, and hopefully, you know, if they look at it correctly, you know, that may bring some doubt and when they review this.
And this false allegation, I mean, probably everybody that's involved in sex offender treatment probably has been involved in that in some way. I know I have in my practice, particularly in the youth sphere, because we got family members and stepkids and other, anyway, and so there'll be an allegation that somebody did something. And what I'll do as a pretrial treatment provider, as part of my assessment, I may do an allegation-specific polygraph. Okay, and I'm doing that saying it's part of my treatment. Okay,
right.
It's not for the defense, but I want to know what I'm treating here. And if somebody did it, then then we need to know that, you know, or treat that accordingly. But I mean, there have been quite a few times with adults and adolescents where the client, in my case, vehemently denies, you know, either the allegation, or there'll be four or five different aspects to the allegation, and maybe two or three aren't true, you know what I mean? But whether it's the whole thing or certain parts of the allegation, they'll vehemently deny that, right?
Sure.
Which is understandable, and we know that sometimes criminally minded folks vehemently deny and they're just lying, but as time, I get more and more cases that have an element of false allegation. Of course, I refer those to you, and when that does happen. But anyway, but that's a thing. I mean, it really
Absolutely.
Is. And I think there still is an element of lock them up, throw away the key. If their lips are moving, they're lying. So I mean, I think we really need to get in there. Like you said, we're human beings. They're human beings. We need to get in there in our quest for the truth, you know, and do the work. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what you said is very important. Not all allegations are true. We know that. that. And, mm-hmm. and there's a range in the literature on false allegations. And typically the accepted range is between 6 and 36%. With us getting to higher percentages when you have a lot of factors present, you know, like the contentious custody battle and that sort of thing. There can be some motivation, parent alienation syndrome coming into play. But, you know, what you're talking about is really important when you have someone in treatment who says, hey, I didn't do this, that polygraph examination can be a very useful tool for confronting them. Hey, you show deception on this. Let's talk about this and see what the deal is. And as you've seen, most times the person comes back and says, okay,
well,
you know, and they'll break through.
And another thing I want to add in there is they'll either perhaps a prosecutor might come back, well, that's not admissible in court, mm-hmm. But I'll say, yeah, but it's totally within the scope of my duties
right.
as a treatment provider to get this information. Mm-hmm. So whether, right, so whether y'all want to use it or not in the court venue, I'm going to use it as part of my, you know, mm-hmm. treatment assessment. That's and right. usually, you know, then there's a little bit of irony in that if the individual was placed on probation, they'd be doing polygraphs regularly anyway. So it's pretty interesting how it's good here, but it's not good in the beginning.
You know, you say that, and I run into that all the time. And you, as you're saying that, I can think about those situations I've been in where I'm talking to a prosecutor or a defense attorney to the prosecutor through them. And, you know, the prosecutor will say, well, they're not reliable. We don't use those. And I think, well, if he does go on probation, you're going to order him to do these polygraphs. So that just doesn't make sense. But we know why. You know, their focus is on, you know, demonstrating this person did commit this offense. And there's not a whole lot of times I see a prosecutor who's truly interested in, let's look and see if there is an alternative explanation. Let's look right. and see if maybe this isn't true. And in many cases, I just kind of shake my head. Why are they even bringing this case to trial, you know?
Right.
So, yeah, but I like hearing you talk about, and of course, as you know, one of our rules is we have to use objective measures to verify
right.
a person is telling us the truth. We can't just rely on what the offender says, and what you're doing is exactly what we're supposed to do. Yeah.
Right. And again, I don't know if you want to mark on the, in the research about expert opinion versus more empirical, you know, there's some stuff there and I don't want to ever be in a position. Well, I shouldn't say that, but, you know, oh, well, it's my expert opinion, you know, without backing that up with some sort of empirical measures, hopefully in plural or whatever. So I didn't want to bring that out.
Yeah, yeah, no, you're right. You're right. The research is very clear that our own opinion, just from our own analysis without anything else, is right. not so great. And that's why we have standardized risk assessment tools. That's why we use polygraph examinations, objective
Is there
measures.
A percentage above chance?
A percentage above chance for
clinical expertise opinion.
Yeah, you know, of course, it depends a bit on
the study.
Your knowledge base and how you've been doing it. And I'll say something about that after I say this.
Sure,
yeah, it's kind of in the 60s percentages in terms of, okay. of our ability. But I'll tell you what's interesting, two things. Number one is that typically when you have someone who's been in the field for a while and they're making that clinical judgment, they're actually pulling from those statistics and from those risk assessments they've been using. So it's kind of a quasi-individual estimate,
right.
bringing in some empirically supported
right.
information. The other thing is there's a lot of research. This kind of falls into deception detection also. There's a lot of research that shows that over time, those people who really work in this area of determining truth versus lie, you know, police officers and so forth, the longer they are operating in their position, the longer they're in the field, the more confident they become in being able to determine risk, truth
right.
versus lie, but the worse they get.
Oh, wow.
So there's not an improvement in doing that. They start off bad. They start off, you know, like the flip of a coin,
right.
and then they get worse over time.
That's funny. So there's this direct correlation of ease of rendering and inaccuracy
sure.
as a function of time, probably.
Right.
Wonderful stuff there. That's really good. Okay, so if I want to move into the police interrogation read method type stuff a little bit, whatever you're comfortable doing, but
sure.
what a police interrogation methods and false confession. So let's talk, please
yeah,
talk a little bit about
yeah,
that.
Those great. Those two things go hand in hand. You know, there's a lot of work I do in false confessions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when people hear false confessions and think about how those occur, we're typically thinking about that stereotypical, traditional, you know, 15-hour interrogation where the individual is not provided any food, water, you know,
on top of that, yeah.
exactly, the things that you see on,
yeah.
on television. And that's true. Those things can lead to someone saying something that is true, that's not true,
mm-hmm.
for a variety of reasons. But we also know from some newer literature, and I say newer, I'd say from the late 90s and into the early 2000s, which for us is recent, that we're learning that even situations where you don't have a lengthy interrogation or situations where the individual doesn't have a mental health history, or they're not an adolescent, those things that typically we look for to lead to a false confession, normal people, so to speak, do falsely confess. And we've got some really good data, a lot of good data that comes from the Innocence Project.
Does that mean innocent people? When you say normal, okay.
Yeah, well, normal people who, you know, let me back up. Sorry. So with the false confessions, traditionally you're looking to see, you're looking for two things. One, you have the personal characteristics, and then you have the external factors. Personal characteristics being, do you have mental health issues? Are you young? Is there some kind of an issue going on with you where you're susceptible to stress? Are you the type of person who can be led easily? So we'll look for those individual personal factors. And then the external factors would be that environment, you know, the lengthy interrogation or what happened, the tactics that were used, you know, the promises of, you know, good things happening. You know, I can go to the prosecutor and tell them you were completely honest. And if you don't tell me that you did this, I'm going to have to go to them and say you're not helping. You know, those kinds of things. When I say normal, I mean people who don't go through those things, people without all those personal factors and who maybe go through a 45-minute interrogation. We're learning that even those people can falsely confess, and we don't know all the reasons why, but we just know that. And where we really know that these things do happen is when you look at studies from, like, the Innocence Project. Mm-hmm. You know, they're the ones who will go get convictions reversed with DNA. So we know the person didn't do it.
Right.
And what they found that is in about 25 to 30% of DNA exonerations, there was a confession.
Wow.
So 25 to 30% of the time, when we know someone for a fact did not do it, they confessed. And so we know these things happen. We know they happen at a higher rate than anybody has ever believed before.
What other empirical, there's obviously, what empirical data or research instruments, or maybe there's, And again, I do not know about this area. Are there risk assessment tools, other things that are validated measures that you're using in this interrogation arena? Or is it just pretty much more standard criminal justice research and you're extrapolating on that?
Yeah. So one, we're looking at a lot of the research on deception detection. Okay. Albert Breach, who's in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. There's Gudgeson, Saul Cassin, these guys who've done a lot of research in this area. Okay. So we follow that and take a look at what they found, what they're looking at. Kim Drake, who's over in the UK, she's the one who's looked more at normal people confessing. And so we look at those factors and see what's present. Also, looking at a lot of the techniques that have been used and the studies done on those. You know, you brought up the Reed technique or the Reed method. Reed developed that, and he's got a mental health background like us. Mm-hmm. He's not just an officer, although he was, but he comes from mental health. And he put this technique together, these different stages and steps that officers used to be trained in everywhere.
Yep.
And it was, the purpose of it was to elicit a confession. What they learned pretty quickly is this can elicit false confessions quite easily. And it's been banned in different countries. Now, if you talk to officers nowadays, they will tell you, we don't use the Reed method. We're not even trained in it. Wicklander Zulofsky, which is an organization that does interrogation training, used to train on this. It became such a big deal that one day they posted on their website, send out mailers saying, we no longer train the Reed method. And so it was a big deal to really separate yourself from the Reed method. However, in cases even today that I do, when I watch these interrogations, there are components of the Reed method being used. You know, you hear, you come in and I'm the officer and you didn't commit this crime, let's say, and I tell you, and let's say it's a sex crime, and I tell you that, well, you know, I've got DNA evidence and I don't even need to talk to you, Bruce. I've already got everything. I just want to hear your story and give you a chance to be honest so that I can go to the prosecutor and say, this is a good guy. He made a mistake. He's being honest. Now, if I tell you I've got DNA evidence, you may not believe that it exists, but you're wondering, what is it that's there? So through that, you can kind of lead you. I can lead you to start saying, well, you know, maybe when I gave her a hug and maybe, well, did you think your hand went down? Well, maybe it did. Okay, thank you for telling me your hand went down and touching. Next thing you know, you get a big report that says you've admitted to touching the child. And so it's this method that really pushes toward that that confession. And I'll tell you this. I was doing a presentation for the American Polygraph Association, a bunch of police interrogators. First question I asked is, what is your objective when you do an interrogation? All these hands go up. First person answers, to get a confession.
Yeah, I knew it. Yeah,
that's true. That's what they're looking for. And they're not horrible people. In their mind, they're dealing with somebody. This guy's done something. I'm going to get him to tell me that he did it. Problem is, innocent people will confess to things they didn't do.
Is there a point where it's, so in other words, you have a persons of interest, and then you clear, if they're cleared, then okay. So it's only, is there some sort of clearance that takes place now before you get the full court press read style type of intervention?
No, not necessarily. You'd like to think that.
Right.
They vet out everything. Look for alibis, look for corroborating evidence separate from that. But no, many times it's very quick that they bring someone in and they start going through this process. And, again, what I see consistently are those things where the person's told, look, I don't think you're a pervert. I don't think you're like these other guys I deal with. I'm not really going to have to worry about you. I think you made a mistake. Well, if you've never been in trouble, especially if you've never been in trouble and your belief is they're here to help, you know, you're going to be more likely to say, well, you know, maybe this happened, maybe that happened. You're trying to come up with an answer too. Why would this be said? Right. It's being said for a reason. And oftentimes they'll say, is this person lying? Is this child lying? And we don't want to say, well, yeah. Most people will say, well, I'm not saying they're lying, but maybe they misunderstood. And you're kind of slowly and gently, many times, walk towards saying something that gets you into the arena of something perhaps happened. And I've seen many people go from no, 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 to yes, I did. I'm very sorry. And then to get a written confession, they don't ask you, would you write your confession down? What they'll ask you once you get to that point is, well, would you like to apologize? Yes, I would. Well, here, write an apology letter. Well, now you're writing your confession. Mm-hmm. So when we get into the really, you know, bad techniques that can elicit false confessions, those are the things that we see. And I really wish there could be an education for people growing up. Hey, here's what can happen. Get you an attorney before you go talk to them.
Right. Don't even show up there because, yeah, or get an attorney before you go. Because like you said, a lot of people will either, one, respond to their authority. Well, I'm just being cooperative and being cooperative with the police, and that'll be good. And then number two, and they don't. Or you'll get somebody in there who thinks that they can outsmart, you know, the process.
That's a great point. You know, people, especially those who, and I keep saying this, people who've never been really involved in the criminal justice system, never been in trouble beyond maybe a speeding ticket, you know, think to themselves, well, yes, I'll come talk to you. I'm innocent. I'll come talk to you. I'm happy to help. And we have this belief that if I don't, I look guilty. And some people even believe if I lawyer up, that makes me look guilty. And I've seen officers tell a person, if you want to get a lawyer, I've got concerns about you. What are you trying to hide? Well, you can't do that. You shouldn't be saying those things. And it misleads people.
Well, if you lawyer up, I'm going to lock you up.
Exactly. And so that's kind of what I focus on, looking for those things that happen that potentially could lead to a false confession. And then we talk about that and explain that to the trier.
Okay, great. So, and then the forensic interview evaluation, is there any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so that's kind of involved with the false confession, child sex abuse. You know, whenever, in most every state, whenever a child makes an outcry or there's an allegation of sex abuse, the child is taken to what's called a forensic interviewer. And for those who don't know, that's someone who's specially trained to talk to a child with the intent of avoiding any leading or suggestive questions, nothing that might cause the child to say something that's not true. And the idea is that we have this really nice, comfortable, safe environment where the child can go ahead and tell whatever story it is that they have to tell, which is fine. One, there's no evidence that really does much of anything to help an investigation. You can get some information where they can go look for corroborating evidence from that. But we've got some research from some other countries. My fiance, Shelley Stevens, a criminal defense lawyer, found some great research. And, that it's kind of like these other countries are looking at us as, what are you doing? You know, you're using these techniques and things that are problematic. And with those techniques that are problematic, there's this belief amongst these forensic interviewers that I see consistently that there's certain information I'm looking for that not only corroborates, but it gives credibility to what the child says. Mm-hmm. And, for example, some of those things are they look for what are called sensory details, you know, what the child talks about in terms of what they saw, heard, smelled, tasted, what did it look like, what did it feel like. And if they get that information to them, that means it was experiential, which while they may not say it on stand, it suggests that increases the chances that it did happen. Well, there's no research that supports that. Right. And so I'm watching for that, looking to see what they're looking for there. Peripheral details, you know, there was a bed, it was this color, there were pictures on the wall,
right.
Curtains on the wall. They get all these environmental cues because it appears to place the child into a real event that really did happen. They also get into talking about signs and symptoms of sex abuse and just a whole host of things that appear to be, and from the layperson's perspective, appear to be associated with actual child sex abuse. So not only do I look at the forensic interview to see if they follow protocol, do they use leading questions, do they use, you know, anatomically correct dolls and drawings and props, you know, those can be problematic, looking for those, but also when they testify, you know, I'll go in and help with cross-examination, and when they talk about these things that are important to tell a jury, sensory details were present, peripheral details were present, you know, here's the way a child responds to sex abuse, and this child has mm-hmm. these symptoms. What I'll do is help the defense lawyer to cross-examine and to confront on those factors, and then I'll give rebuttal testimony.
Okay.
And what's interesting is you can ask that forensic interviewer, what research do you have that supports that sensory details are important? Consistently what you get are things like, well, I've been to trainings. Right. Most of the time they can't remember the training they went to.
Right.
And when I go up there, what's important for anyone who does this work, if you want to be good at this and you want to get rehired, I get to say, well, here are the 5 studies that have recently been done that talk about this specifically and tell you that this is unhelpful and it's prejudicial. Here are the studies on this factor, on this factor. And so I think that when we talk to jurors about what's important to them and what they hear from experts, that support, that empirical support becomes very important versus just their, you know, anecdotal information that they provide. And sometimes you can even help avoid that testimony getting in by explaining to a judge, this is very prejudicial, and here's what the literature says about that. And again, I want to be clear, it's not about trying to get a not guilty verdict on somebody. It's about making sure accurate information is provided so that decisions are made, not on misinformation.
Absolutely. I was going to ask, you focused a lot on the forensic interview of the mm-hmm. child. Are there other instances where you're involved with the CPS investigation at large, not just the interview, but other aspects of the CPS?
Sure. So in two ways. One is evaluating it from the defense side perspective and mm-hmm. how they did their work, their investigation. Because, you know, I teach criminal profiling and work in that a bit, which is fascinating. But you can kind of do a little bit of that with their investigation and see how they came up with these things. But you know, also when CPS gets involved, you're traditionally bringing in a counselor to do work with the child. So evaluating their approaches, as you know, there's 2 different ways to treat kids. When you have abuse issues going on, you have the truly abused kid and you have the allegedly abused. And the allegedly abused kid is the one where you really need to avoid getting into details about the alleged offense, because we can create these false memories and through rehearsal get a story that's not true. Mm-hmm. We want to focus on symptoms and not on getting into the event until we have a confirmed abuse situation.
Right.
So a lot of analysis of those kinds of things, and that sometimes ties into court when the counselor comes in and says, here, we've been working on, you know, trauma narratives and abuse cycles, and if this isn't true, you're creating false memories and things like that. So, but on the investigation side, you know, just analyzing what their process was, how they went about their analysis, who they interviewed, who they talked to, how they did these things, where they got their information, and how they align that information with the potential of something being true. That's what I look at.
Is there some sort of, like you said, well, I was trained or whatever. Is there some sort of, well, this is the industry standard type of argument, or is there, conversely, is there research that supports or that identifies that industry standard?
I would say there's not really an industry standard in
that's terms a bad of, term, but I was just
well, no, I like that term because we want to look at, you know, what is the cutting edge approach that we're using? What is that standard? Because that's what we all aspire to is just to making sure we're staying up with the most current literature, because as you know, things change. Mm-hmm. And what we were doing in sex offender treatment, for example, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, we don't touch today, you know, because we know not only is it bad, it creates, you know, higher risk levels.
Right.
And so we always want to keep up with that. So I would say, to use that term, that like the industry standard that you said, what that means for me is that we're maintaining a good, intimate relationship with that scientific literature, and developing your approach through this new information that we get. You're getting that from your experience and things you've gone through, trials and tribulations, but also through what that research tells you we should be doing.
You know, I'm hearing you talk, and sounds like a lot, or a good bit of what you do is really intelligently talking about the existing research and what the research says and how it applies to a situation. And interestingly, I'm a master of science, this ABD person. And I, even by you, I was encouraged, hey man, get your PhD, get your PhD. And it's so important because, I mean, wouldn't you agree that last degree qualifies you, right, to say, look, not only, you know, I can talk about the research and here's what it is and here's what it says, mm-hmm. because I am PhD, Dr. Aaron Pierce. I mean, can you speak to the importance of getting that last degree?
Absolutely. You know, going back to my original intent was to be the marital therapist. And even after getting into the forensic work, doing the sex offender treatment, I was happy with that. But going to court for revocation hearings, for the most part back then, you know, good opposing counsel would always start with, so Dr. Pierce.
Or Mr.
Well, they would start with doctor.
Yeah,
And you know, we can't let that go on record. No. And so I would have to say, well, I'm not doctor. And they would say, oh, you're not. Well, they look at their stuff. Well, what are you exactly? And you have jurors who will look at you. And so I decided, you know, I'm getting tired of that. I need to go back and get my doctorate. But the terminal degree in your field, in our field, is a PhD, PsyD, EdD.
Correct.
You know, in the mental health area, in psychology. Getting that, if you're wanting to work in forensic psychology, if you're wanting to go to court, if you're wanting to consult trial strategy, you're wanting to practice doing assessments and then going into court and talking about those, the terminal degree becomes very, very important. People, you know, assign a higher level of prestige with that. I think it adds to credibility. Just having doctor in front of your name does that. I know a lot of great people like you with masters who go into court and do wonderful things, and they're very credible and do great, and people respect them. I would say that in most areas, you have attorneys who are looking for that terminal degree, and they want to see that.
And had it not, and I'll tell you, I mean, I'll be very frank and honest with you. I still go to court from time to time. I did have a fairly illustrious career in the Justice Department.
Yes, you did.
Was comprised of a lot of work and a lot of assessments and a lot of experience. And I rely on that as they're qualifying me for an expert. And even still, you know, because I've been in court where the guy across from me had a PhD, but he'd done, you know, 200 statics, and I did thousands, you know, tens of thousands. And so, and it really, and so, but even still, I would say, folks, that having the terminal degree, as you put it, is just a huge weighting factor. If you're rendering an opinion and having to testify in court and then discussing research findings, it would lend itself, hey, do you have this research-based degree? Do you have doctoral level statistics? Do you have this? Do you have that? Program evaluation, all the good stuff that we know you have. And so that goes without saying. So I did, you know, it's easy for somebody to say, I want to be like you. And like, yeah, well, you know, do you have the requisite training and experience to do that? So, but anyway, I appreciate you sharing that.
Be quite honest, you're talking about, you know, regardless of degree, you know, your background and what you've done becomes really important in terms of credibility and so forth. I know when I first met you, you know, I was kind of, I want to be you, because you talked about who you worked with in the Bureau, you know, the Manson people and all that.
These
people we read about in the school, you actually worked with them.
Yeah, so. Squeaky Frogs.
Exactly.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah, it's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's something nobody else gets.
You can't.
You can get 3 PhDs and not get what he has. And, you know, so.
I'd walk up to you in a conference and I'm like, how much is your tuition for your program? And you say, excellent. And I walk away with my paper coffee cup. Like, you know what? I'll just stay in my lane, you know, such as it is. But no, man, fun stuff. But I do want to underscore, you know, and I'm super proud of you for doing that, because you were, you didn't have that degree, and you were doing contractual work and kind of mainline work. And so you really took the time out and did what it took to get that degree. And now, man, you know, sky's the limit type of thing, of course, but man, it just really has opened opened a great, you know, opened stuff up. I think part of our show here, there's folks that are coaches, okay, mm-hmm. and they may or may not have a bachelor's degree, and then they get a coaching certification of one variety or another. And so we're really, I'm always preaching, stay in that coaching lane. Do not try to be a therapist with your coaching certification. It's not even a license. It's an unregulated industry for the most part. Coaching, right? Mm-hmm. What is that? What does that mean? Now, there is coaching malpractice, and there is this kind of ICF standard. It's a baby APA, if you will, for coaching. Mm-hmm. But we're just, oh, man. And so, you know, it's, you know, I just really want to implore people to stay in their lane, because if there is legal trouble or there is something, you know, lack of credentials are going to be real, real quick. So,
And one final thing to say about that, you know, for anybody who's looking at that advanced degree, whether it's the bachelor's, master's, or doctorate, and you're thinking, man, how do I work that in my life? You know, how do I do that? And what's the cost going to be? Yep. You know, I would say this, you know, one, there's no better investment you can make than in yourself with something like that. I mean, you will get your money back many times over. Okay. But yeah, you think about what you want to do was required of that. And, you know, for example, if you're, you know, master's level and you're wanting to get that PhD, you want to get something that leads to licensure. I see a lot of my students who will get into, we have a forensic PhD program mm-hmm. that doesn't lead to licensure. Right. And, you know, the problem with that is many students aren't thinking that way. They're not thinking about getting a license. Well, the license is necessary for practicing, which is doing the counseling, doing assessments, mm-hmm. anything that's part of the field of practicing within that scope of practice for that license. Now, you can go be an expert in court and testify with no license. You can travel around the country, and I don't have to be licensed in the state to go give information, because that's what we're doing, just giving information.
Correct.
That's not practicing. But you've got to consider, what is it ultimately I want to do? And what do I have to be able to do that? And for most people in my field, licensure is going to be required. And so you want to make sure that program you're in, that you go to, is designed to lead to licensure. That. And you also need to take a look at your licensing boards in your state. What are their requirements? Do they require you, for example, in psychology, to graduate from an APA accredited university, or like in Texas, it just has to be regionally accredited? So understand what it is that it takes and what you're going to need versus getting that degree and finding out, I've got to do another 2 or 3 years to get this.
And that almost happened to me. I went to the University of Wyoming in Laramie clinical program, and here I was kind of pivoting, getting an LPC license, right? Mm-hmm. And lo and behold, man, I was sweating. Almost had to take career counseling, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because that was just the board couldn't quite. Well, what is this? And like, it's that class, you know what I mean? And they had to call Wyoming and do that. But that shows the rigor of the board, you know. The difference, you know, between all a certification is, and maybe you can help me with this. A certification is some piece of paper you paid for that said some other people outside yourself recognize your work or your experience or credentials, but a license mm-hmm. is way more impactful than just a certification, because there's a board and there's rigor and there's education rigor. You want to, I'm sure you have some great compare and contrast things.
Yeah. So there's a significant difference, you know, with a certification. You've got to be careful about what you certified in, because a question can come up. What did you have to do to get this? If the answer is, well, I sent a copy of my master's degree and $150, you know, that doesn't say there's anything that necessarily that had to happen or you had to prove in order to get that. Well, licensure is different, because you have to have that degree, mm-hmm. and then you have to go through an evaluation process, take mm-hmm. the state exam or national exam to be able to get that. And as we know, you know, licensing boards are established for one primary reason. That's to protect the public.
Correct.
You know, so that when you hire someone, if they're licensed, you know, they at least had to go through different standards to be designated as someone who knows how to do this. It doesn't mean they're good at it, but you know they've had to go through something. Without licenses for anything, guy says he's a plumber, you hire him, he causes $10,000 worth of damage. Right. So if he's licensed, if he's got that certification through the state, then you know he's at least gone through something to prove to somebody he can do these things. And so there's a pretty good distinction between those things.
Right, and also for the continuing education credits, and I am not, I'm a member of this, you know, I paid online. Hey, we need your CEUs. I sent them. I know this is our board. I sent them. Hey, and they gave me half of the credit. And I got another delinquency notice for the other, because that, you know, I have ATSA and I have the seesaw. You know, you're talking to Mr. Training over here. Yes, mail it back twice or three times. Finally, got the license. Anyway, it was just getting that right person to do that. Look, I'm not complaining. I'm glad to do it because this shows the power of a license. How there's rigor of, did you get your CEUs? This is a 2-year. You know, did you get the enough victim hours, offender hours, and ethics? Did you do this? Did you comply with the state law? So, I'm joking a little bit because I had to keep going back and back and back, and I'm sure I left something out. So I don't want to put.
Well, what you went through with that is just a testament to how much we scrutinize. You know, did you go through something that really does provide the training that we contemplated that you do? And yeah, I know that happened to you because I see those and it comes to me and are these approved hours and you know that. So, oh yeah, we know Bruce, go ahead and prove
it. That was absolute seesaw. You know, it's not like I went to John's barbecue and had, anyway, I had some speaker come in there about, sorry, I digress. This isn't a personal vendetta here. Hey, real quick. I know we are running into time. I guess tell us a couple minutes about the TV show. If you want to, and then how folks after that, how folks
So real brief on the TV show, and consult on a true crime show called Reasonable Doubt, not the TV series, but a true crime show. Just wrapped up the fifth season, and typically I get called in, just like you said.
Are you on every episode?
Not every episode. It's just like any true crime show. They'll bring in an expert to opine about some particular issue. Typically, I'm brought in on eyewitness issues. I do a lot of work in eyewitness accuracy, and so I'll go and review. We review murder cases where there was a conviction many years ago, look to see if there were problems in the case, errors made, and then refer on to the Innocence Project if we find those things. And so, yeah, I've been doing that. It's a lot of fun, great people on the show, and a lot of work, a lot of record review. But, you know, it's fun to go do the analysis, and we do little experiments along on the show also.
That's awesome, man.
Hopefully we get a season 6, we can do some more of that stuff. But that's been...
And what network does it air on right now?
It's on Discovery Plus.
Discovery Plus, okay.
Yeah, Discovery Plus. So we're on the ID channel and kind of transitioning to Discovery Plus.
It may be a bit sold to Oxygen. It just depends on how they migrate it and sell it. But and the name of the show again is?
Reasonable Doubt.
Reasonable Doubt, folks. Reasonable Doubt. Okay, so look for Dr. Pierce on that.
Yeah. And in terms of getting in touch with me, I have a website. It's aaronpierce.co. It does not end in .com. Another Aaron Pierce got the .com, so we had to find something else.
That was nice.
aaronpierce.co. It outlines what I do. Have student internships available and that sort of thing as well. And then, of course, all my contact information is there, and certainly always happy for people to call who are wanting to move in this direction to call and ask for advice or some direction. Happy to do that. So, yeah.
Yes. And yes, and Dr. Pierce has always been a great mentor. He's been open. I've called him in the past. I had some complex questions come up with clients and court appearances, and so he has been very willing and very open to talk to folks about things, and so he certainly is open to that. So I want to thank you for coming on the show today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a blast.
Yeah, man. So I think it's really good to kind of showcase what you're doing in your practice, and there's just not a lot of people like you in my estimation that are out there. I mean, you have a very nice skill set of things. And so I'm glad for everybody to be able to see it. So with that, it's going to look like a bad selfie, but here we go. I know at least y'all are spared, but for most of the show, but anyway, here we go. So have a great rest of your week and come back next week to the Concierge Coaches Show. Wayne will be back. And remember to see us on Instagram at concierge_coaches. Our Facebook page is Concierge Coaches Show. And again, my coaching website is conciergecoach.net. And so without further ado, we'll see you next time. Take care and have a blessed week. Bye-bye, everybody.
You're listening to the Concierge Coaches Show with Bruce Cameron and Wayne Fritz, only on LA Talk Radio.